March, and you know what that means. It's les rendez-vous de la francophonie.
Check out rvf.ca to discover all the activities and contests happening across Canada.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm here with Brandon Brownlee. Today, I am going to talk on a subject that we haven't given much attention to so far in the many years of running of the Canadian Philosophy Show. Not much, anyway. And it's environmental ethics. And I want to start by making a disclaimer or a qualification that there's a cultural bias here. So when we talk about environmental ethics, we're often speaking from the Westerners or the European point of view, as opposed to, say, an indigenous person's point of view. And we know that traditionally indigenous cultures in much of the world, including North America, have very different relationships with the natural environment than do European settlers, colonialists, or Europeans. So having said that, I wanted to provide some context for a discussion on environmental ethics from a Westerner's point of view, because I don't think we can talk about, as Westerners, we can't talk about our relationship to the natural environment, how the natural environment is important or not important, how we value the natural environment, unless we understand our cultural context and the rose-colored glasses or the filters or the viewpoints from which we analyze the natural environment.
Yeah.
So it's important to go back, not a long time, but a few hundred years back to England, which is from where many of the roots of Western metaphysics, Western culture come from. Not all, of course. Some are rooted in classical times, Greece, Rome. But there's actually a track all the way from classical times to the Renaissance to England. But what better way to get a sense of our being Westerners, Europeans, attitudes towards the natural environment than to go straight to the source? So here's a couple sources for you. Very famous works. I'm going to read excerpts from, first from two treaties of government by John Locke. And I have to say, I am very bad at pronouncing some of these old English words, so I probably will make mistakes and fumble through a few of these words because this is written in old English. And in one section of the book, John Locke writes, "Though the earth and all inferior creatures be common to all men, yet every man has a property in his own perfone. This nobody has any right to but himself. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his. Whatsoever then he removes out of the state that nature hath provided and left it in, he hath mixed his labor with and joined to it something that is his own, and thereby makes it his property. It being by him removed from the common state nature hath placed it in, it hath by this labor something annexed to it that excludes the common right of other men, For this labor, being the unquestionable property of the laborer, no man but he can have a right to what that is once joined to, and left where there is enough and as good left in common for others. He that is nourished by the acorns he picked up under an oak, or the apples he gathered from the trees in the wood, has certainly appropriated them to himself. Nobody can deny from, but the nourishment is his. Nobody can deny but the nourishment is his. I ask then, when did they begin to be his? When he digested, or when he ate, or when he boiled, or when he brought them home, or when he picked them up? And it is plain, if the first gathering made them not his, nothing else could. That labor put a distinction between them and common, that added something to them more than nature, the common mother of all, had done. And so they became his private right. So this is one of the most important concepts conveyed or asserted by John Locke.
Yeah. The mixture of labor as the appropriation of natural goods, or of nature, I should say.
Right. And this particular passage suggests, is suggestive of some of the more detailed theories that Locke talks about, which is that before such mixture of human labor with the natural land, the natural land was virtually worthless. It's worthwhile to the extent that mixed with human labor, it can become productive. So this is an important concept to understand about the English values and the values of the colonists who came from England and settled, many would say invaded, colonialized North America. Incidentally, this led to another phenomenon of which many of us are quite aware, which is that this pitted the colonists against the indigenous people who were already living in North America. And we know that, but why? And here's one reason why can be gleaned from this Lockean assertion about the value of land to the extent that it's of utility to people and then mixed with human labor becomes valuable and becomes the property of the humans who labored on that land, who tilled the soil, which is that the indigenous peoples that lived in North America, particularly the New England, because that's where, you know, the English originally settled, colonized, the indigenous people were nomadic. They did not have this concept at all of land ownership. They moved from place to place as the seasons changed, and where they moved, where they moved their tribes to, their communities to, was where they could continue growing crops, feeding themselves. And they were sensitive to the seasons and sensitive to soil depletion, such that they would move on rather than deplete the soil to where it was no longer productive for their sustenance. So the idea of sustenance and survival amongst the indigenous people was from moving from place to place, depending on the their ability to sustain themselves. It was the English who had a very different view of the relationship between people and land. English, of course, as exemplified in this Lockean statement, was to,
It doesn't seem like the indigenous communities are, you know, unfamiliar with using the land to survive. They're just using it in a very different way that doesn't have the image of appropriation or of retaining it in a certain way. I mean, the image that Locke kind of gives me is, well, you own it. I mean, that's the whole basis of his art, or that's what he's trying to ground in this discussion that he's writing is, okay, when does someone own something? And it's when you mix your labor with it. Well, you can use something and mix your labor with it, but not possess it in a certain way. Or, I mean, possessing it might preclude making it useful if things like being sensitive to the way that the land kind of responds to repeated use, you know, it needs a break once in a while to stay fertile. I mean, possession of it would not be how you would use it intelligently. I mean, it speaks to a practical error in Locke, at least, because if this doesn't work, if appropriating it for repeated use seems to make it useless, then that's not a very good way of defining how you have something. So we're definitely bumping up against a case where, you know, this philosophy doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you're describing some practical consequences, sort of some scientific ramifications of a different metaphysical system.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the important point, is that it goes much deeper than just ownership. It goes to the very relationship between people and the natural environment around them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of information that indigenous people, many of whom were nomadic, including the tribes in New England at the time of colonialization, not only didn't think that they owned land, but they also were much more sensitive to of taking care of the land, right? Of not overgrazing or depleting soils. And they're more in touch with, so rather than stake a claim on a particular piece of land and building fences, which is what the English people did, indigenous people moved around because they were more in tune and sensitive to the, whatever the climate was, whatever the seasons were, whatever animals that they used for food were in that area. So there was more of a relationship of sort of co-sustenance rather than staking down a permanent dwelling, fencing it off and saying, as English people did and the colonialists did, saying, this is mine, I own it, and I'm going to milk it for whatever it's worth.
Yeah.
So that's part of the story, part of the context of relationship to nature that we talk about when we talk about it from a Westerner's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledging the best I can, you know, representing best I can what some of the alternative indigenous views were. But here's another, I'm going to read a little bit from another famous work, Evolution and Ethics by T.H. Huxley and Julian Huxley, written in the, well, it says here, 1893 to 1943. The process of colonialization presents analogies to the formation of a garden, which are highly instructive. Suppose a shipload of English colonists sent to form a settlement in such a country as Tasmania was in the middle of the last century. On landing, they find themselves in the midst of a state of nature widely different from that left behind them in everything but the most general physical conditions. The common plants, the common birds and quadrupeds are as totally distinct as the men from anything to be seen on the side of the globe from which they come. The colonists proceed to put an end to this state of things over as large an area as they desire to occupy. They clear away the native vegetation, extirpate or drive out the animal population so far as may be necessary, and take measures to defend themselves from the re-immigration of either. In their place, they introduce English grain and fruit trees, English dogs, sheep, cattle, horses, and English men. In fact, they set up a new flora and fauna and a new variety of mankind within the old state of nature. Their farms and pastures represent a garden on a great scale, and themselves the gardeners who have to keep it up in watchful antagonism to the old regime. Considered as a whole, the colony is a composite unit introduced into the old state of nature and thenceforward a competitor in the struggle for existence to conquer or be vanquished. Under the conditions supposed, there is no doubt of the result if the work of the colonists be carried out energetically and with intelligent combination of all their forces. On the other hand, if they are slothful, stupid, and careless, or if they waste their energies in contests with one another, the chances are that the old state of nature will have the best of it. The native savage will destroy the immigrant civilized man. Of the English mammals and plants, some will be extirpated by their indigenous rivals. Others will pass into the feral state and themselves become components of the state of nature. In a few decades, all other traces of the settlement will have vanished. Let us now imagine that some administrative authority, as far superior in power and intelligence to men as men are to their cattle, is set over the colony, charged to deal with its human elements in such a manner as to assure the victory of the settlement over the antagonistic influences of the state of nature in which it is set down. He would proceed in the same fashion as that in which the gardener dealt with his garden. In the first place, he would, as far as possible, put a stop to the influence of external competition by thoroughly extirpating and excluding the native rivals, whether men, beasts, or plants. And our administrator would select his human agents with a view to his ideal of a successful colony, just as the gardener selects his plants with a view to his ideal of useful or beautiful products. In the second place, in order that no struggle for the means of existence between these human agents should weaken the efficiency of the corporate whole in the battle with the state of nature, he would make arrangements by which each would be provided with those means and would be relieved from the fear of being deprived of them by his stronger or more cunning fellows. Laws sanctioned by the combined force of the colony would restrain the self-assertion of each man within the limits required for the maintenance of peace. In other words, the cosmic struggle for existence, as between man and man, would be rigorously suppressed, and selection by its means would be as completely excluded as it is from the garden. So I'll stop there. That's T.H. Huxley and Julian Huxley from Evolution and Ethics.
I was going to say, the first thing that strikes me is this. I mean, okay, so you, the case here is, you know, a British kind of culture or system, we'll say. You have English colonizers that move in and establish an English colony. They settle it in the fashion that they're used to, or in whatever way that they're sort of used to living along in their old ways. There's almost a commonsensical question of asking, okay, what is the point of going out into the world and encountering all this new fauna and, you know, flora and, you know, all of these new people and ideas and whatnot, and just staking your own and squaring up your old ways. I mean, maybe it is, maybe it's kind of survival. You need a place to land, first of all, in order to establish yourself. But what they're doing is more or less sifting things out. There's no, in this scenario, the way that things seem to ideally, quote unquote, play out is that things get completely sifted, that what is wild, what it belongs to the state of nature, gets excluded from the state of civility in the colony. And then so what seems to be being taken there just is, because everything that is there is being excluded. It's more or less an extension of what you are moving away from, that is British land or, you know, an English system. Really what you are simply getting is land. If you're excluding everything else out, if you're abstracting everything, all you have is the space. You have new space. You've expanded what was going on before. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that's not so insightful, but that's kind of what I'm seeing, is that in this case, what is it that you are getting if you are going there and excluding everything? If it's just more of the same, well, it's just more of the same. So I don't know.
What struck me first is I couldn't help but think of Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes. What the Huxleys are doing here, in my view, is they're extending the Hobbesian view of the state of nature. They're extending it and they're applying it to colonialism. So not only is there a theoretical state of nature, as Hobbes talked about, but now the Huxleys are becoming more specific about what one would find in that state of nature, in the Hobbesian state of nature. What actually constitutes that state of nature? Like, what's there? So they're actually making it less theoretical and more concrete.
Yeah.
So what the Huxleys are saying here is that the English colonists, upon arrival in North America, found that state of nature. They actually found in physical reality.
Yeah.
The Hobbesian state of nature. And what was there? What comprised that state of nature? Well, native rivals, whether men, beasts, or plants. The state of nature which the colonists found in North America consisted of indigenous people, human beings, and nature, and animals, plants, human beings, and all those native indigenous life forms were the exemplification, I believe the Huxleys are saying, of the Hobbesian state of nature. As Hobbes said, no rational person would want to live in such a state. So this is the justification for the colonialists implementing Hobbesian principles of the social contract. The colonists will fail, according to the Huxleys, they'll fail, and the state of nature will overrun them if they don't construct laws and a society and a social contract in just the way that Hobbes said must be done.
I think it's a little, so I think you're right. The allusion to the state of nature does evoke sort of Hobbesian themes, but I think that there is a difference here between Hobbes's exploration of the state of nature and what we might call, what do we want to call? I don't know. I don't even have the language for what we would call, you know, indigenous land that has not been encountered by Europeans yet. What Hobbes is doing with his state of nature in the Leviathan is giving a reasonable account of how a state of society sort of spontaneously arises given the rational capacities of some of the animals, humans, in this state of nature. So in the Hobbesian picture, a state of society arises out of a state of nature, whereas in the Huxleyan case here, you actually have the state of nature being encountered by a like a lawful or a group or a community that already kind of considers itself in a state of society, that already has laws and has this story about a state of nature. So I'm just, that's just something I'm noticing. And I also say this because a lot of the times that I see people bring up the state of nature and then allude to Hobbes, I think that it's not exactly what Hobbes is talking about. Hobbes does kind of introduce this idea of a state of nature, but then a lot of people pick it up and use it in their own ways. Like Rousseau also has an exploration of a state of nature, but it's not the same as a Hobbesian state of nature.
It's interesting you brought up Hobbes and the intent of Hobbes and the purpose of Hobbes. And it's sort of off topic, but it could be a good topic for another time. But I just want to briefly respond to that particular point, then I'll go on with back on topic. But just to sidetrack a little bit here, my view, which I think is different than yours, of Hobbes, is not that Hobbes was making an empirical statement. I don't think Hobbes was saying, well, this is what happens. You have people in a state of nature, and then what we observe is that they form a society, they form a political state, and that's sort of what happens when you have a state of nature. I don't think that's what Hobbes was saying, in my view. I think quite distinctly from that, I think Hobbes was making a justification for the political state. He's making a justification for a social contract. He was making an argument about what the authority and justification is for laws,
right?
And for countries and political states. I think that's what he was doing, rather than making an empirical argument. I think he was making justification argument.
Yeah,
but anyway, a rational argument, yeah. Not an empirical argument.
I don't think he was making an empirical argument. That's why I said I thought he was giving a reasonable account. It has to, there has to be some connection between the two. But in any case, yeah, it just has to, because his goal is ultimately to justify a state of society.
Right. And that's why I know you may not agree completely. That's okay. But that's the parallel I'm trying to make. I think that.
Right. That is a justification.
So I think Hobbes was justifying the existence of the political state and of laws and why people should be bound to obey, obliged to obey laws, because the alternative is a state of nature. And I think in parallel with that, I think the Huxleys here are saying, well, this is the justification for the colonization of North America.
Yeah, it's interesting because with the Hobbesian state of nature picture, whether it arose out of that or not is not what Hobbes is interested in. But the consequence seems to be that if we don't have this, then we'll fall into some kind of state of nature. So the justification is, we don't want that. Let's have a state of society.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, to read this, yeah, the sentence right out of the book here says, the native savage will destroy the immigrant civilized man. That's right there in a nutshell, the worldview of the Huxleys and many, and really the colonial worldview, English colonial worldview, which is that you have on one hand savages, on the other hand you have civilized people. Savages are the indigenous people living in North America and other places in the world, and the civilized people are the English. So it's a very obviously racist isn't even a strong enough word. It's really a genocidal, in my view, a genocidal statement, a genocidal concept. So I'll move on from this, but I just wanted to lay this backdrop. And this is from the words of a couple important theorists, English theorists, John Locke and Huxley, the Huxleys. That's where a lot of this comes from. You know, we talk about a lot about colonialism and have the First Nations people, the indigenous people have a different view of Earth, you know, of Gaia, of sort of coexisting with nature, taking care of nature. Then you have the European view of conquering nature, civilizing the native, civilizing nature. This is where it comes from. It comes from these English theorists. These are two of the very important ones. So that lays the groundwork for at least some sense of what, how Westerners, as distinct from Indigenous people, related to nature. But I wanted to be more